Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best with these things, just turn into a conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V. It's such a pleasure to welcome Mark Brandy on the podcast today. Mark's best-selling novel, Wimmera, won the British Crime Writers Association debut Dagger and was named Best Debut at the 2018 Australian Indie Book Awards. It was also shortlisted for the Australian Book Industry Awards Literary Fiction Book of the Year and the Matt Rochelle Award for the New Writer of the Year. His new book, The Rip, is an urban crime novel that slowly and masterfully hooks you in, then shocks you with the horrific crime and the dread that the characters you care about aren't going to make it alive. We have a great chat about Wimmera, The Rip, and everything in between. Enjoy. Thank you so much for your time today, Mark. I absolutely loved both Wimmera and The Rip.
Thanks, Danny. Great to be on your podcast. I've been looking forward to it.
Now, The Rip explores the experiences of young people living or surviving the streets. Why was this an important story for you to tell?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one because when I sit down and write, I'm sometimes not really conscious of why I'm writing a particular story. I know it probably sounds odd, but it's more in hindsight that I start to see why I might have told that particular story. And I think with The Rip, I heard someone say recently, and I thought it was quite good, that when you're writing a novel, you need to have something to say, but you might not know what it is. And I think that was true of The Rip. When I started writing and started writing the main character and her voice, I had no idea really where the story was going to go, or there was no other characters at that point. The first chapter, as it presents in the finished book, is essentially, of course it's been edited, but it's essentially the same content. It was just me getting to know this person, finding out who she was, where she was going. And in terms of why I think I wrote it, or why it was important for me to write it, there's probably a few different factors that have led into it. And I think partly was my experience of people suffering from drug addiction on Melbourne streets. And it was something which was increasing, and I was seeing it particularly around Richmond and Abbotsford in inner city Melbourne, on Victoria Street, particularly in the last few years and leading up to 2017. And in 2017, I think we had something like 34 deaths from heroin overdose in a four-block area, this small, very small block [S2] Wow. [S1] Area of Richmond, and that got a lot of media attention at that time. So I think I started to become more aware of that. And then around the same time, homelessness became quite visible, or more visible, on Melbourne streets too. And it was kind of interesting to see the community reaction to that. And I didn't know that I was going to write a story that was going to feature these themes or these issues at that time, but I was just kind of fascinated by it, because there was kind of echoes in the way that people were reacting to the issue of homelessness as there were in people reacting to the heroin issue, because you had local traders kind of saying, you know, we don't want this here, this is bad for business, and residents kind of feeling a little bit aggrieved as well. you also had some people who took a more kind of humanitarian bent, I guess, and then others who were quite hardline and probably thought, well, why are these people doing this, you know, in a country like Australia, where there are opportunities, etc. So I probably got, this is a really long way of me answering this, but I probably got kind of more interested in class and inequality and how that manifests. So I think that those were probably the themes driving me to write this book. But I didn't want, at the same time, it's not a sermon or anything like that. Like it's a story about these characters and what happens to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Simplest level, yeah.
And it's a very fast-paced crime novel, and I just tore through it, as I did with Wimmera. I just, you know, read it. I don't know how authors feel about this when you spend so much time on a book, but I honestly just tore through them in like 24 hours. I'm sorry. But I guess it's a good thing too, right?
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm sort of funny. I have differing speeds for different styles of books, yeah. And you know, there's some. It just depends. Some things you will tear through, and I do the same. But my version of tearing through is probably fairly slow, I would say. But I love the fact. I love hearing that the people are engaged by the story, and you know, want to see what happens because it has that element to it at a plot level, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with crime fiction, I almost think it dictates the pace in which you read it. Like, you don't get to dictate the pace in which you read it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And probably, too, with first-person perspective, like you're having the rip as well, because and it's present tense. So you're being told what's happening in the moment. So it's like if you leave that story, it's like the story is no longer continuing without you. So you dive back in and you want to see what's happening to this person and how they're engaging with the world. But I think crime fiction, it's a general comment, but I think that crime fiction tends to be pretty fast-paced.
Yeah.
But in saying that, you know, the first half of Wimmera was a little bit more laconic and I think reflective of the time and the way that time played out for the boys as well. So you can certainly tweak speed as you go along.
And it's almost like you are the person who controls how we read it, because you know there is that kind of slow burn, but because you know the genre, I've read enough of them to know I know the pace is coming, so I think that gets you reading as well, like it keeps you in the book.
Yeah that's probably right. I sort of don't tend to think of myself as so much in control of what's happening with a reader at the other
puppet
end.
Master. So
I think, I feel it's funny, like now with the book coming out, the rip coming out, I feel now I'm very much in readers' hands, you know. Yes. It's kind of up to the readers and what they make of it.
Yeah, which is interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I pull apart books like the English teacher nerd that I am, so I apologise in advance.
No, that's good.
But I love when you talked about class, because you're right, it's not just about homelessness, it's about class. And I found it so interesting, the perspective of the narrator, when she says, "It pisses me off when they look at him," she's talking about the dog at this moment, "even more when they look at me. The mums with the babies in prams usually just ignore us. That pisses me off too." And I just thought that was such a great voice, but then really talking about how, even though we say, you know, we don't live in such a class-based system, we really, in fact, do, don't we?
Oh, definitely. And I think that, you know, for the central character, she's on kind of the receiving end of that in many respects. And I do think there's a mythology about class in Australia, like that we're classless and anyone can make it if you work hard and all that sort of stuff. And I think that, you know, probably did exist at some point, and certainly like in the 50s and 60s, the country was very different, opportunity was very different. But now I think there's research that backs it up as well. I won't get too nerdy about it, but if you look if you look at kind of class mobility, so the extent to which people can rise above the class that they're born into, that has gotten worse and worse since the 1980s, and we're in the bottom of the OECD, of the OECD in terms of class mobility. So the situation that you're born into in this country and in a lot of other countries as well really is the large determinant of whether or not you will be safe, whether you'll be happy and healthy, whether you will own a house and all those things. A lot of it, unfortunately, is set very early. And I think we kind of kid ourselves that isn't there, that, you know, anyone can kind of make it. And certain stories are held up as, you know, the boy from Broadie who's, you know, made millions of dollars, and that's all wonderful. But that's the exception and not the rule. And I tend to think that we're, in you or I, in our situations, we're fortunate to have support. We've got families behind us. If something goes wrong for us, health-wise, or, you know, touch wood, anything else major, relationship breakdown, whatever it might be, there's people there who will support us and help us. But for a lot of other people, that just is not the case. And when something goes wrong, they're very quickly in a precarious situation, or on the street. The protagonist is giving voice to that in some ways, but she too is just dealing with the realities of her life day to day, and just, you know, she's got a different frame of reference than you or I, but it's still her frame of reference every day, and how she's living, how she's enjoying life, and how she's trying to improve.
And it's a lot harder for her, and we see that through her perspective. But what I found really interesting as well, and it's only a tiny part of the novel, but the little social commentary through it, that, you know, that it isn't just the homeless people who are unhappy, it's the people in the city conforming to that. And she has the time and space to see people around her, and she says, I watch the suits go by. A lot of them look pretty miserable. They just stare at their phones all day. So even if you are middle class and have a job, it doesn't necessarily mean you have any more contentment in your life. I thought that was such an interesting thought.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, I've been that suit as well.
Yes.
Different points, sort of, you know, walking around kind of in you know, zombie-like at times. So, yeah, I think it is just, you know, exactly that. The contentment takes very different forms for different people. And you can have all the accoutrements of wealth and comfort, and still your soul can be empty. But you can, and I'm not advocating that it's okay for people to sleep rough. That's not what I'm saying. But you can be sleeping rough, and your soul can be full in a lot of ways. So it's not a cut and dry thing. And I wanted to give, and not in a patronizing way, but I wanted to give color to that world, to her world, to Anton's world as well.
And I think she does. She has that space to observe people, and we do in our busy lives often get stuck, you know, not being present. And I thought that was just such an interesting point that, you know, we could take into our own lives, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think we miss out on so much, and it's sort of, sometimes I think this is kind of an odd thing to think about, but it probably just reflects the fact that I'm a bit odd. But I sometimes think that if you went to jail, you know, 20 years ago, and were held sort of, you know, in solitary confinement, or perhaps had little access to the outside world, and or even if you did, for that matter, when you stepped out into the world now and just watched people, you know, walking around with their phones and their headphones in, you would just be stunned. You would just think, what has happened to this place? And I'm not sort of saying that, you know, people are heartless or don't care about other people, but it's very difficult to know or observe the things or people around you when your attention is just so focused on the device in front of you. And we're all guilty of it.
Yeah.
We all do it, and we all like to be entertained, we all like to be informed, but I think that sometimes we miss out on a little bit, and perhaps that's what the central character is talking about there.
Yeah, I really liked that she had these insights, because I think often people who do sleep rough or people who are homeless, I think they're is often the opportunity to undermine them, or, you know, think, oh, you know, they don't know about our lives, etc. So I liked that she still had insight, and she was that very, you know, sort of developed character that had insight about other things and thought about the world in different ways.
I think, you know, intelligence and smarts take on different forms, and if it's not sort of in the traditional kind of school-based way, it can be in other ways. It can be street-based, it can be emotional intelligence, or all sorts of things. So I think that she reflects that.
Absolutely. Now, talking about suits, you said you were a person in a suit and you graduated with a criminal justice degree, worked extensively in the justice system, and it's interesting that your novels kind of explore the other side of the law. Was this something that always intrigued you?
Yeah, that's sort of a kind of a long story, because I've got three older brothers who, and this should give you some context. The eldest one is a forensic scientist with Victoria Police. The second eldest is a prosecutor with Victoria Police, and the third works in the criminal records area of Victoria Police. The fact kind of that, I mean, both my career and my interest, I suppose, have been shaped a lot by the stories that I've heard, through the years, and the kind of, you know, horror stories and various other things going on. But I think that the kind of, I guess, the deeper dimension of crime and what it means to a society and what it means to punish certain people, and how the law operates more at a moral level in some ways, is of interest to me. And I think that, you know, it's people are fascinated with crime, and I'm fascinated with crime as well, and I find it intriguing, but for so many different reasons. And I think that there's something primal at work in a lot of ways, our interest in crime, because we look, and we may not even realise it, but we gravitate toward crime stories because we want to learn something about that kind of deviant behaviour, and we want to know, you know, potentially how to avoid being a victim of it ourselves, or sometimes we might even want to live vicariously by seeing someone do something really vengeful in a story too. So I think that there's such a breadth of experience and quite extreme experience that you can have through crime. But my career was an interesting one, because I did a number of different things when I worked at Department of Justice. I was there for about 10 years, and probably the one job I had there that shaped me most was a period I worked as a political advisor for the corrections minister. So I got to know the corrections system very intimately, and inside of Victoria's prisons as well, and some of the offenders who were there too. So it was a real eye-opener, that experience.
I imagine it would be. And do you get together with your brothers and just kind of let them talk so you can get more material for the next book?
I think they're conscious of that now. if I'm around, they might be careful. You know, they say it's one of the worst things to have a writer in the family, because your personal lives will be mined as well as your professional life. But I love hearing those stories for sure. And you never know where something's going to spark as well, because I've never sort of taken a story and adapted it completely. Yeah. But you take little bits and pieces here and there, for sure.
I just think having dinner with you and your brothers would be the most interesting experience. into crime.
could be quite gory.
It'd be like one of those Making of a Murderer podcasts. Yes. The novel obviously focuses on drug use and addiction, but never glamorizes it, which I think, you know, it's kind of important. Well, it does kind of, but then it shows you the consequences. I quite liked the description, but she says, "It's like something beautiful and warm is filling you up, smoothing off all the rough edges." And it's such a lovely description, but then you do kind of make sure you don't glamorize it, because then, you know, a couple of pages later, it's like, "My arms are a bit shit at the moment, so I pull down my jeans and find a decent vein on the inside of my left thigh right near the edge of my knickers." So if you're almost convinced, that kind of unconvinces you, right?
Yes. Well, I didn't have a real message there about the upside and downside of drugs. I was trying to reflect a reality of it for a person living in those circumstances, and I think, you know, addiction is it's an understatement to say it's complicated. Yeah. It's very complicated for people, and it affects people from all walks of life. But the beggar on the street or the window washer is a lot more visible, and so we see that and we think, well, there's the manifestation of drug addiction. But the reality is we don't see the surgeon or the barrister with a cocaine addiction, or, you know, someone else who has the wealth and the means to still carry on their life without it becoming such a visible problem. So I was reflecting, I suppose, that person's experience, that character's experience of drug use. And I think that partly for her, that there's an element of escapism, certainly, but that then shifts into a dependency, as can happen.
And I like the idea of you saying that it's just visible. And so then, obviously, like you said, people are addicted from all walks of life, but it's the visibility, and that creates fear. And I felt like fear was a motif throughout the novel, because there's a heightened sense of it from the people living on the street, and in turn, people fear them. And it's a pretty terrible way to wake up in the morning, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a real sense of otherness about from both sides in some ways. Not that they're sides, but and I probably at a personal level experienced that or witnessed that in Victoria Street, because I'd see this kind of world of drug trade, drug use, sometimes overdose too, that you would see on the street, and then this other world beside it, kind of carrying on as though it doesn't exist, and both are kind of almost mutually exclusive and not interacting with each other, and it just struck me as so odd. And I remember at the time I was I would take my parents once a week down to Victoria Street for lunch. We'd have like a bowl of soup at one of the Vietnamese restaurants, and my dad has dementia, so taking him down the street, like when people are drug affected sometimes, or dealing, and they're kind of looking for people to interact with, my dad, whose kind of inhibitions had completely disappeared, would interact with them. So it was a really it was a challenging thing to manage him through that, but it made me more aware, I think, of what was going on. It made me sort of, you know, pay more attention to the environment around me, because I kind of had to shepherd my parents through it in a way. But I, you know, it's funny, because I kind of find, like that, those characters in that world, I'm kind of drawn to. I find that, and not in a, like a non-voyeuristic sense, I just find it interesting. And I suppose, you know, the characters that I write, like the characters in Wimmera and in The Rip, tend to be on the margins of life, and I don't want to say never, but I can't see myself writing sort of a middle class drama somewhere out in the suburbs. I just seem to be drawn to these more extreme kind of circumstances, and particularly just with the contrast that's there between what is largely a very, very wealthy society that we live in, but that there are people who are being left behind, and that is becoming worse.
I love that you said that, you know, you deal with characters on the margins of life, and I think readers are really drawn to this too, obviously, especially with the rise of crime fiction and psychological thrillers. And, you know, looking at both your books, even though we are talking about, you know, people who you said don't have as much support probably as, you know, middle-class people, etc., but we're all kind of... we all could be in these circumstances if just a couple of things go wrong. You know, like you see the boys in Wimmera, you know, they're not bad boys, but circumstances make them act in a way that they probably wouldn't have thought they could have acted. And then in The Rip, you know, you've got these circumstances, all different type of circumstances that have made these people homeless. So it's not completely foreign to any of us. You know, a couple of things go wrong and we could be finding ourselves in some very precarious situations as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we kid ourselves that we are completely insulated from that world. And partly maybe that explains why we're sometimes willfully ignorant of it, because we don't want to face that truth. We don't want to face that reality that ourselves or a loved one or someone we know could potentially end up in a quite dire situation where they're doing things that are extreme, because it does happen, and we know, just putting aside the homelessness and addiction aspect, that sometimes when people commit what are seen as heinous crimes, we'll often, you know, hear neighbours or family members saying, you know, they're such a quiet person, they're so nice, and you know, because sometimes people, they are, and things happen, and you know, a confluence of different events and stresses, and a decision is taken, which is a terrible decision sometimes. And people can do awful things to one another. And we're never that. Partly, I think you're right that could explain some of our interest in crime fiction, that we. Part of us knows we're not too far away.
And that moral ambiguity, which, you know, even if we may not go to the extremes in novels, you know, it's always present in our lives, and we have to continue to make choices. And sometimes, you know, they're morally ambiguous, and I think that's why we explore these dark sides. But along with that, you know, you have this beautiful relationship between Anton and your protagonist, and there's so much ugliness in their lives, but they're so kind to each other, and there's humour between them, and it just shows that despite all this ugliness, you can always find some light, you know, through friendship and through love. And I thought that was such a nice element throughout the novel.
Yeah, again, it felt very natural. I mean, I loved Anton, and I think that they, had this beautiful friendship and relationship that was nurturing in a lot of ways, and I think, you know, if there are parallels, I suppose, as a thing about Fab and Ben in Wimmera as well, that, you know, through sometimes very dire circumstances, we need other people, and we need contact from other people, you know, whether that's emotional or physical. I think that it's just part of being a human being.
I really like the idea, the extension of that, when she, you know, thinks there's something wrong with Anton, and there's this sense of the collective unconscious. I love that. Tell me where that came from.
Oh, yeah. I actually think that might have come from a short story class that I did at RMIT. I had this great a teacher there, a poet, Anya Wolwitz, and she taught a short story class there that I was part of, and I remember her discussing the collective unconscious, and you know, I hadn't come across that sort of idea before, and it's just funny, like I was sort of fascinated with it, and I'm not sure, like Anton, I completely understood it correctly, but I was sort of fascinated with it and then kind of forgot about it. But it's so strange how, you know, years later, you'd be sitting down and writing this manuscript, which you never know whether it's going to see the light of day or not. And that sort of comes to you and you think, oh, that seems like something, yeah, that Anton would be talking about. And, you know, because he has this interest in, if not the metaphysical, kind of bigger issues about the world and how we live. He has these thoughts and interests which the central character relays and sort of to the reader, which she is sometimes sceptical about as well, which I kind of like, which because we all have those friendships with someone who, you know, always has read an article or something somewhere and it's blown their mind and they tell you about it and you don't really fully grasp what they're saying. And I wanted that dynamic for both of them as well.
Yeah, I loved it. And I just loved that, you know, maybe people that aren't attached to their phones every day, maybe they do end up with these beautiful human connections and they do have that collective unconscious. I'm probably reading way too much in it, but I liked it. I thought it was lovely.
Thanks, Daddy. It's really gratifying. It's funny, the little details sometimes just different things will connect with different readers. Yeah. And that's just the beauty of literature.
Absolutely. Now tell us about your writing process. Did it change from one novel to the next?
Well, I started The Rip just after, not long after Wimmera came out. So I didn't have, I suppose it was a different, I wasn't conscious of it, but it was a different environment to be writing in because part of me knew that I had a book out there, so it's a bit of a different equation. The process itself, well, I when I'm drafting the first draft, I try to stay in touch with the manuscript in some way pretty much every day if I can, and partly that's through bitter experience, because when I was writing Wimmera, and if I took a break or was forced to take a break at some particular point in early drafting, it would take me a while to pick up the threads of where I was, what I was thinking. It didn't matter what notes I wrote at the time, it just take me extra time. So I just find it's more efficient where I can to stay in touch with it. But the drafting process probably in total maybe took it was quick compared to Wimmera. I think Wimmera was my first book, so it was a lot harder. And I think I probably attempted something with shifts in time that was a bit of a challenge first up, and the Rip, I suppose, once I had that voice, which was really strong and clear to me, I just felt compelled, really, to follow it and to stay with it as much as I could, because it was just so urgent. So, the redrafting was relatively smooth. So I know if any writers are out there listening to me, that they just hate me saying things like that, because we all go through. I mean, in saying that, like, I'm not the first person to say this, I'm sure, but you have days, like some days where you just be sitting there going, oh, this is going so well. I love this character. I think the story's going to be quite good. And then the next day, it will just be, I can't believe I was ever published. Why do they think they're going to tear up the contract? This is terrible. Well, you know, I just don't even know what I'm writing. I should just go back to a day job. It would be sometimes really just, I would have to will myself to keep going, because I think sometimes, and again, I heard this somewhere else, someone saying that when you're in flow and you're writing and it's really coming well and, you know, you can barely keep up with the ideas and it's just racing out of you, that sometimes when you look back at the manuscript, you won't be able to tell the difference between those times and the times where you just, you know, kept on battling and just getting through it. And that's always stayed with me, that sometimes when you really feel like you're pushing it uphill, that it still might be good. It doesn't, the way you're feeling at that moment doesn't mean it's bad. It still could be good. It still could be useful. So it just reminds me to persist.
Keep plugging away. And it's an interesting career, because much of the time you're by yourself and you're not getting much feedback until the end of the process.
Yeah, it's brutal, isn't it? and it could be really bad.
But I've written 80,000 words. You can't say it's bad.
Yeah, you've devoted all this time. That's why, I mean, it is. Like, I worked in, you know, political offices. They're really brutal environments. They're there's no prisoners taken. If you can't, if you can't take it, you're out.
Yep. It's
as simple as that. They were tough environments. A lot of people were spat out of it. But publishing, in many respects, is a lot tougher, because you're taking someone's dreams and aspirations and something they've worked on for an extended period and, you know, potentially not liking it or not seeing a market for it, or as a reader, when you're picking up a finished book, just, you know, going on to Goodreads and giving it one star. So it's
just because you've had a bad day.
Yeah, I mean, like, so it's just, it's a very strange, you're absolutely right, it's a very strange business, because you're not getting really any affirmation along the way that what you're doing is right or good. And I mean, I don't give out bits and pieces of my work when I feel it's finished. My partner, she'll read it, and then my agent will read it, and then hopefully if it's good enough, it'll go to the publisher. So I don't have those kind of checks along the way to say, oh, what do you reckon? So it's scary. It's kind of scary doing that. But I don't mind a bit of risk, and I think I need probably a bit of risk to keep me going in life.
And it's part of the creative process, isn't it? I mean, it's just part of it. And I just find it so admirable that you did. You left your job with the justice system and you went, I'm going to write. Was that such a big... How did you make that decision?
Oh, it was kind of a progressive thing, because initially I went part-time at work, and I was able to. It was sort of an odd story that I've told a few times, but I was thinking about doing a bit more writing, but I didn't know how to make that leap financially, because I knew, well, I had a sense that I wasn't going to be making much money as a writer, and I had responsibilities. And one of my brothers actually sent me an entry form for Millionaire Hot Seat, you know, the game show. So long story short, I actually ended up going on there and I won some cash there, not like a life-changing amount, but I won a bit. And that enabled me to go part-time at work, which I then started the course at RMIT. So it was more of a progression. But then the leap to writing full-time really came after a bike accident that I had a few years ago. So I was riding down Brunswick Street, and I ended up on the road and had two operations on my shoulder, and I was out of action for about 6 months. And it made me, I guess, question what was important, and I thought I need to give writing a really proper go. And so that's when I went full time, for better or worse. And it was just, I was lucky that it came off to some degree. But if it hadn't have, I would have thought, at least I kind of consoled myself with the idea that I won't die wondering, and that I will have given it a proper crack, and I haven't gotten myself to retirement age and wondered what if. So after Wimmera had been out for a little while, and it was lucky to be shortlisted for an Indie Award, which is voted on by independent booksellers from around Australia, and it won Best Debut for 2018, I think it was. And it was great. Like, we didn't have award. It's wonderful. And it's funny because awards and accolades, you start to think, oh, you know, maybe your family will look at it and think, oh, he's making a go of it. That's pretty good. But an old friend of mine, I ran into him, and this guy Frank, and he said, oh, Mark, I want to tell you, I've read the book, and I really loved it. You must be so pleased. It's doing well. And I was like, yeah, it's good. And he said, oh, I have to tell you too. I saw your mum down the street the other day. I was like, yeah. And he goes, yeah. And I said to her, Mrs. Brandy, Mark's book just won that award, that Indie Award. It seems to be going really well. You must be so proud of him. And he told me that she looked at him and said, he used to have such a good job.
I love that.
And I thought he relayed this story to me, and I just thought, oh, well, it sounds about right. But I mean, like, my parents, you know, we're, and my family, they're happy for it, obviously, that's come off. But in fairness, it's alluding a little bit to what you were talking about before. It's a weird job, you know. It's a strange thing to be doing, to be sitting up in your room every day for a long period, and particularly when you're unpublished at that point, because you don't know if any publisher's going to take it. And it's for other people to grasp what that represents to you, and why it's important. It's a bit of a stretch, I think, sometimes. We can be a little bit demanding of other people, to expect them to share our dreams or joys in a way. I think it's just one of those things. You have to find creative satisfaction in what you're doing. That's the most important thing. If you aren't enjoying writing, if you're not enjoying that process of doing it on a significant level, you know, take up a musical instrument or something, do something different, because life's too short, I think, to be just, you know, like with a Protestant work ethic, just battling away. And I mean, you have to have a level of diligence, but you want to be happy too. It's got to be sustaining you, your soul, in some way. That's probably what I aim for, I suppose, in my work.
But I love that. I love that idea of sustaining a soul. I was having this conversation with someone the other day, and I said, I feel like I've got my 85-year-old self always sitting on my shoulder going, just take the risk. Don't be stupid. Like, you know, once you're 85, you're going to just regret all those things and opportunities you didn't do, even if they're hard now. So I think that's important.
No, that's a good way to think about it. And, you know, we'd be fortunate if it's that 85-year-old self. It could be, I don't want to say it all doomsday it could be the 50-year-old self there saying, hey, Mark, you know, the clock's ticking, and because you haven't got that long.
I mean, see how optimistic I am? I'm like 85, still lucid, still bossing myself around. I'm very optimistic.
Well, I mean, we never know. It's not to be morbid about it, but it's kind of like, and it just passes by very, very quickly, and it gets faster every day.
I know, right. Remember in your 20s or when you were a teenager and life just went on forever? And remember those Christmas holidays, those 6 weeks holidays? It felt like a year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I think sort of, not to sort of, in a really artless way, go back to my book, but like in Wimmera, I think that happens with Fab and Ben. Yes. Like, it's just that it's got that summer that just seems, you know, just stretches out. Yeah. And the school, you know, return to school ads, eons away. Like, and when you start to see them, you just go, oh man, it's over. I can't believe it. It's gone on for so long.
But now you blink and you're like, didn't I just have a birthday yesterday? Like, how's it come around already again?
It's frightening. It really is.
It really is. And what's next for you? So you've got two published, so you can make your mum proud. Is there a third one in the way?
Well, I am contracted to deliver a third one, so there better be a third. I'm probably one of those annoying people who's a bit loath to talk about what they've been working on or are working on.
I always like to ask, but secrets are good too.
Yeah, I just sort of like the magic disappears a little bit for me. I'm probably just superstitious, that's all.
That's fine. As long as there's another one coming where the readers are happy, and that's fine. And look, secrecy is kind of part of a crime fiction novel. You can't reveal everything at once, so it's all good.
This is true. This is true. a bit of tension and suspense.
Exactly.
It never hurt anyone. Exactly. A bit of delayed gratification. Hopefully it is gratification. It's not delayed suffering. So we'll see.
We need that in our society, right? We're just saying we're always on our phones. We need that delayed gratification. It'll make us better. Thank you so much for talking to me today.